Okay, I think we'll get started, if that's okay with everybody. Just a few items before we get to our speaker. Talk a little bit about student projects, and then we'll have our speaker. And if there are people that have missed lectures, I mentioned this last week, all the lectures are recorded, so in order to be credited for attending a missed lecture, number one, have to have a good excuse. Number two, you have to review all the audio and handouts and stuff on the web and write a short paragraph, you know, paragraph to half a page describing the lecture and your thoughts and comments, and I'll give you credit for attending. And please do that as soon as possible because, you know, it's going to get busier at the end of the quarter. If anybody has comments about the speaker, either for the speaker or for me, certainly willing to get emails. And I know that the speaker last week was very pleased to get some positive email to her. So if you have this enthusiasm bottled up about a presentation, you're welcome to relieve it by sending emails. And I'll make sure that the presenter gets it as well. Yeah, one more thing. You know, I'm not a professor, and I'm not even one on TV. So if you call me Professor Jaffe, that's wrong. So I would appreciate it if you just call me Dave, okay? I'm one of you, but just 40 years removed, okay? So for the student projects, we want everybody to have a project picked and a leader picked, and that leader would be a person that I would communicate to instead of everybody. And please report any problems, any accomplishments, successes, you know, to me as you see fit. As you start working on your project activities, you know, working with the people with disabilities and the people that suggested the project, please document as much as possible by pictures or videos if you think that's appropriate, because that really adds to your final presentation and to your report. And I think it would be a good record of what you did here in this class. Okay? And when you talk to people, it's always a good idea to get them to tell a story about an incident or whatever, because that, you know, I think is closer to, it brings people closer to their need and desires. There's a lot of stuff on the website. I want to, you know, put everything I can on there. And in case I didn't say, the syllabus is on there as well. And that includes the grading percentages and stuff like that. So if any questions, again, you know, please let me know. Next week, it'll be our pleasure to have Ted Selker. He's a fellow from MIT Media Lab, and he's out here this year. And formerly, he worked for IBM, and he invented this, you know, the finger joystick. So, I mean, so you see that a lot of places, and he'll actually be here in person. And he's done a lot of work with design, people with disabilities, and stuff. So it'll be quite interesting. Any questions so far? Excellent. You know everything. It's my pleasure to introduce Gary Karp. And Gary, I've met Gary on at least three occasions, and it says on his website that he's an internationally recognized public speaker, trainer, facilitator, author, and editor. And as you see, he's he is a wheelchair user and has been since he was 18. And he's in the Hall of Fame, the Spinal Cord Injury Hall of Fame. So, you know, that's an accomplishment, I guess. He's done a lot of things in his life. He's has a degree in architecture, worked in presentation graphics, and as a designer, production manager. He does ergonomics training and consults with companies in the Bay Area. He lives up in San Rafael, right? And he spends a lot of time talking to companies about disabilities. And he also is an accomplished musician and juggler, as you'll see. And he also has a CD of guitar music. So he's a multi-talented individual. And without further ado, I'll transfer the mic over to Gary so he can start his presentation.
Which has nothing to do with your being able to hear me.
Right.
Dave, we've got to give you some training, so when you do the introduction, you get a huge roar of welcoming applause from the room.
Well, you know.
But that's okay.
They may not know you as much as I
yeah.
know you.
No, it's
but
not.
They will know you after the talk. And they'll give you a double the applause after.
Okay. It's not that I need it much. Thanks for having me, Dave. Thanks for being here, even though you have no choice. The most natural thing that anybody can do, the most understandable thing that anybody does when they encounter somebody with a disability that you don't have, or consider somebody with a disability, is pretty much to be horrified at the notion of it being the case for you. It's a natural, reflexive, automatic human thing to do to project yourself into the experience and for it not to seem too desirable. Am I right with this? Yeah, of course. It's only human. So then you probably next thing consider, well, what it would be like to be them. What is their life like? What's inside of that experience? How does that work? And I find that the natural thing that most people do is they think people wish it wasn't the case, that they don't want that to be their reality, that they wish their disability was gone, that it's a difficult life, that they're waiting for some kind of a cure. Maybe they're angry about the fact of it because of all the potential that it's cost them. You know, there's a whole mountain of negative projection that naturally happens when people initially consider what it must be like to have a disability. And for the most part, it's wrong. That is a big mistake to imagine that you could ever project yourself inside of that experience and get it right. Because there are a couple of really crucial things that we tend not to take into account. And the first is this immense truth that we are amazingly adaptive creatures. And you discover this when you're inside of a disability experience. We have a capacity to integrate the most intense change, the very shift of our identity, our whole sense of self, to be able to let go of plans and dreams and things that we love and to be able to come to some new moment and acceptance of reality. And people do that on a large scale. People do that more than the general cultural view, than our general assumption thinks they do. And that's why there's all of this heroizing, you know, the inspirational disability, because everybody thinks, wow, if they're happy, and if they're out there actually living a life, and if they're not constantly suffering under this immense burden of their disability, they've got to be amazing. They must be the most rare, incredible, astounding, phenomenal, heroic person, because I could never do it, right? This is the typical response to considering a disability, and it is so wrong. Because, again, number one, we find we've got this capacity to adapt. I was injured when I was 18 years old. I had never been in a hospital in my life. And early on, I was struck by this quality of my innate capacity, just because I'm human, to integrate this thing and to move on. It's amazing to me. So that's number one important thing for you to have in mind. Because if you don't have these things in mind, when you work with somebody with a disability, you are likely to treat them in a patronizing way. You are likely to fail to make the optimal working partnership connection with them because you don't get who they are. You don't get how they see themselves or how they view their disability. That's crucial. So this point is huge for you guys. The other one is that disability is just entirely different than it's ever been before in history. It's gone through these phenomenal, do I use a lot of adjectives? Radical changes. There's been really a revolution in what it means to have a disability, in what the actual impact of it is and what the potential is for people and what they can do in the world, in our society, in their families, in the community, in the workplace, wherever you want to put them, with disabilities of all kinds and all degrees. It's all changed. So it means that, you know, we're all operating on a lot of old stereotypes. All this projection that I was just talking about comes from, to some degree, the way it used to be, but isn't anymore. And what's changed, I divide it to two categories. One is that obstacles are falling away. Artificial obstacles. Take a chair user like me. In the past, employment was a lot more difficult for someone like me. Not because of my disability, but because I couldn't get in the door and there was no bathroom for me to use, right? It wasn't the disability that was limiting me. It was an external, artificial obstacle that now is falling away because the workplace, substantially, is accessible. The other side of it is where you guys come in. Potential is expanding through creativity, through design, through engineering, through problem solving, assistive technologies. Possibilities are expanding in ways that they never did before in history. So it's great. Get in the front door, give me a place to pee, but you've also given me technologies that allow, you know, me to do work that maybe I couldn't have done in the past. So take somebody who is paralyzed and their hands and their arms are involved. Someone who is quadriplegic, perhaps from a spinal cord injury like me or from a spinal tumor, or, you know, there's a whole array of reasons. There are even people with post-polio syndrome. Have you talked about these disability types at all? Okay. Not a lot of people in the United States have polio, but the ones who did go through that experience in the 50s or whenever it was, you know, they started using the full capacity of their life on half capacity of their body, and they burned it out. So there actually are people with post-polio syndrome who have become quadriplegic. So anyway, that's a bit of an aside. But that person can still drive a computer as well as almost anybody else without the use of their hands and their fingers. Right? On-screen keyboards, voice dictation technology, head cursors, eye cursors, they can control the screen, word prediction and expansion software. And there's this whole array of technologies that allows everybody to be able to access the world through that little machine. I'm trying not to get involved in that. In 1980, I worked on a $250,000 machine that did 64 colors. That doesn't work. I have to give up the voice. It just doesn't work anymore. I don't know. We have a hard time with this aging thing. It's just, it's a challenge. That's right. Anybody see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan? I'm sorry. And I don't mean on YouTube. Being there was different. Elvis, that's right. Okay, I know. You don't want to hear the aging stuff. I'll stop. Same thing with vision impairment. Somebody who's blind, JAWS, and other types of screen reader technologies allow them to be told what's on the screen, designed in a way that allows them to navigate, to set markers, to save things and locations, and again, full access to technologies. Wheelchairs. I'll go into more detail about that in a bit. But, you know, it's a long, long, and growing list. So, you see what this is about? Removing obstacles, expanding possibilities for people who have real potential they didn't have before, who aren't obsessing and dwelling on the fact of their disability, but it's integrated into who they are, and what they're interested in is what is possible for them. What they care about is what everybody else cares about. They want to have a life. They want to be as independent as possible. They want to be involved. They want to be productive. They want to be contributing. They don't want to be taken care of. They want to use personal assistance and attendant services, maybe to help them get dressed if they need it, or whatever types of things of that sort. But that's another adaptive resource that they use in order to be in the world doing what they're capable of doing from their mind, from their heart, from their set of values, from their belief in themselves, all the stuff that everybody else is about. What it really means is that the disability is actually a small part of who this person is. We just deal with it we just sort of manage it no more than we have to so that we can get on and do everything else that we're interested in. You know, obviously, in my case, I've been a musician and all the stuff that Dave mentioned. Not because I'm such a super talented person, but I've just been interested in these things, and I didn't let the world tell me that somehow because I have a disability that I'm not allowed to do them or that it's not possible or whatever. You know, I just have done what I've done because it's about me, not about the disability. So that's a big part of what you want to be doing and how you'll gain respect and connection and stronger working collaboration with someone with a disability when you keep their disability in balance with who they really are and when you put the emphasis on finding out what they're actually interested in and who they are as a person. And the disability is the thing that you're doing the needs assessment around what they're interested in pursuing, and in order to mitigate the unnecessary limitations that prevent them from doing something that is possible, right? You're working together to find potential. And the potential is huge, and it's emerging, and it's historic, and I'm just so psyched about it because it's amazing to be part of this, to be involved in the broader disability community, to be part of this amazing moment in our history when you see this whole category, this whole class of people, millions of people, who the world keeps seeing in old terms, but they know better, and they're proving it every day. I mean, you all know this. You're all seeing more people with disabilities visibly in public more than ever before. Am I right? Just nod your heads. Yeah. Okay. And that includes athletics. How many of you know what the Paralympic Games are? Everybody. Almost everybody. Right. Who can tell me what the difference is between the Paralympics and the Special Olympics? Anybody? Want to take a shot at that? Do I see your thumb go up there? Yeah. Partway there. But it goes a lot deeper than that. The Special Olympics are generally for people with developmental disabilities, and that's not exclusively true in the Paralympics. But any other shot at this? The Special Olympics is a motivational event that everybody gets to compete. Everybody gets rewarded in some way for their participation. The Paralympics is the Olympic Games for people with disabilities. World-class athletics participated in by people who have to rise to an extremely high world standard, who have to devote themselves and work as hard at their event as any Olympic athlete. So the Paralympic Games and the Special Olympics are vastly different things. And the people involved in them are there for vastly different reasons. And not anybody can get to the Paralympics. It's an incredibly hard thing to achieve. And the world records just keep falling and falling and falling because the level of what they're achieving keeps getting higher and higher and higher every year. And that's why the Paralympic Games happen on the site of the Olympic Games every 2 years now by contract. Right? It's integrated into the Olympics community. Who would know in this country, right? We've had the Paralympic Games in Salt Lake City and in Atlanta. Who knew? I was in Australia almost 8 years ago for the Paralympics down there, and the Australians got it. It was front page news, you know, every day. They showed up and packed the place, and they got that it was about the games. It was about the people. It was about the sport. It wasn't about cheering on the wonderful, heroic people with disabilities, right? See, we're still all victims of an attitude in this country that is not up to speed with the truth. So I've gotten involved in this because of my own experience 34 and a half years ago. I was 18. I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, which is now under about a foot of snow, I hear. And there had been this huge storm in July, in June, and it really ripped the whole place up. And a neighbor hired a few friends of mine and I to clear his property. He had trees all over the place, and so the grass was just totally covered with broken branches. And he needed somebody to come and clear them up. And so, you know, we agreed, and he was offering us $500, which at the time was a lot of money for three guys. And there was also a tree that needed to be cut down. And we said, sure, we'll do that too. So, you know, I think back on this story, and wonder how it is that I agreed to do something that I was utterly unqualified to do. Why would I climb up 25 feet into a tree with a chainsaw? And I had never touched one before in my life, but that's essentially what I agreed to do. And part of it is just that sort of 18-year-old, you know, sure, could never happen to me, and you know, it's probably about my personality. I'm an idealist. I tend to think that everything's going to turn out all right, no matter how many times things haven't. My brain, my psyche still tends to go there, so it's sort of a lifelong process for me to work on that one. And I was thinking about my friends. I wanted to earn the, you know, the attention and the admiration of my friends for succeeding at this. And I was already over 6 feet tall. I was sort of the only one who could do it because nobody else could go up there and reach this branch. The neighbor wanted us to cut off this branch first before we fell the tree because he was worried about damaging surrounding trees. So, climb up that tree. No belt, no rope, no nothing to hold me in place. I know. It's shocking. We tied a rope around the branch that I was about to cut off, but nobody thought to put anything around me. I was actually leaning forward, and I had a very solid stance. I felt secure. It just never occurred to me that I was in danger. But when I cut into that branch, it was large, and it started breaking off of its own weight as soon as I got a couple of inches into it, which totally startled me, which meant that it was releasing all of this weight from the trunk that I was standing on, which shifted, and it essentially just threw me out. And I landed what felt like flat on my back, though it was really on my butt. And here's where the engineering comes in. The force went up my spine, and my break occurred at T12 and L1. Anybody know what's special about that spot?
It's a thoracic,
right. And there's something else about that point that I'm looking for. Those things are all true. Exactly. It's where the rib cage ends. So that means there's reinforcement there at the spine. So the force met that point, met that reinforcement, and that's where the crush happened. And then it compressed my spinal cord. Circulation was denied from my spinal cord long enough for cell death to happen in the axons, and now the messages can't get from my brain down through to the muscles below my hips. See? Completely normal in the hips. So this notion of, you know, paralyzed from the waist down is not universally true. It depends very much on where the injury is on the spinal cord. There are some people who are paralyzed from the thighs down, some from the chest down. So it's this waist down thing is really generally not what it's about. And by the way, that's important. The fact that I have use of my hips really improves my upper body balance. I have full normal use of muscles, my entire trunk and my hips. That gives me really good balance. And that comes into play in the chair. We'll talk about that in a bit. How am I doing with time? Good. So, I was taken to the hospital. I was operated on that afternoon. They cleared the broken bone. They reassembled my vertebrae using bone from the hip. They held it together with a little twist tie. You can still see it in the x-rays. There's a little metal tie in there. And then I had to spend 6 weeks laying straight while the surgery healed. So this is 1973. Since then, what has become the norm is they install braces, and then you can immediately be up and active. And there are pros and cons to that. For some people, that means that, you know, within days of their injury, which sometimes, often in fact, includes other kinds of injuries. There might be broken bones, there might be concussion, there could be some organ damage, you know, whatever, though, they get them up within a matter of days and they ship them off to rehab. Well, in 1973, nobody went to rehab until they were medically stable. That rehab is the place where you went to work really hard on gaining independence and optimizing independence. That meant working out. That meant learning skills. That meant being psychologically ready, willing, and able to commit to the process of optimizing your independence along with the course of whatever recovery might be taking place in your body. Because actually, I did gain a little bit of recovery. I've got some lift in my knees and a little bit of movement here that I didn't have when I was lying on the ground. So I didn't know whether I was going to walk again or not. Nobody ever told me specifically that I wasn't going to walk again. But that didn't stop me from participating fully in rehab, because I got that 6 weeks of settling in and recovery and this big, amazing outpouring of attention and visiting, and boy, did I get to be the center of attention. And so by the time I got to rehab, I was, you know, ready to go for it, because I knew I was going to be spending some time using a wheelchair, so I was game for it. But what's happening now is people get sent to rehab very early. The insurance company wants to get them out of the hospital. They want to start the clock ticking on their rehab coverage, which in many cases might only be 30 days, and then they're home. Well, I spent 6 weeks in an acute setting and 7 weeks in rehab, 13 weeks total, and they told me it was fast in 1973. Now the norm is 4 weeks, for some people less. And this is for somebody with paraplegia like me. Somebody with quadriplegia, they're going to get a longer time. It's different in the Veterans Administration, if you've got workers' comp. You know, there are differences. But on the whole, this is one of the ways where historically we're not moving forward, we're moving backwards. So, again, all the more crucial the role that you play is you're going to be dealing with people who are really left on their own to optimize their potential, to find their own answers in ways that, you know, in the past, they used to get a lot more support and a lot more assistance for doing. So I was lucky in that way. And in rehab, what they did was they pumped me up really intensely. I have stretch marks on my shoulders. The exercise was that intense that my skin couldn't keep up with how fast my muscles were expanding. So my deltoids were just, you know, growing faster than my skin could keep up with, because I was going to be pushing a chair, because I needed to be able to do this, to be able to lift my body up to relieve my skin so I wouldn't get pressure sores, skin breakdown. I needed to be able to make transfers in and out of my car, movie seats, airplane seats, the couch in my living room. They even taught me how to fall and get into the chair off the floor. There was time for somebody like me to get that opportunity, to get that strong. Now people really have to do it on their own, because they get there before they're even medically really able to commit to it often, and they don't get enough time to get that strong. So this is kind of the context of what we're in. So that's basically the story of, you know, sort of the injury and recovery process such as it was. I just sort of got out there and got on with it. I got back to school and just got on with my life best as I could, and sort of took what I, you know, whatever happened. I wanted to walk, of course, but I wasn't going to let that stop me from having a life. You know, the idea of sitting around and waiting somehow for my body to recover, and like, oh, okay, now it's all right, now I can go out in the world, because now I'm okay. And, you know, the notion that being in the world as a wheelchair meant that I couldn't feel okay about myself, or that I couldn't be out in the world, was just not okay. It's very immediately clear that that was not okay. Which is why, you know, it's a personality thing. You're going to encounter a lot of different people with a lot of different personality types and a lot of different coping approaches to this if they have an acquired disability. They're not only working with people with acquired disabilities, are they? The AT world. Yeah, so I will make that distinction. So let's say we're talking about people who have recent disabilities. So they're going through some kind of an adjustment process. And everybody copes in their own way. You know, I was one of those sort of type A, gung-ho, approval-seeker types. And I was lucky. I was an active kid. I was performing as a musician, worked in my dad's drugstore. I was very accustomed to being, you know, involved and busy and interacting with people and visible. So as weird as it was to be out in the world in the beginning using a wheelchair, because it sure didn't feel like me. You know, in my mind, I was actually thinking to people, you know, out in public around me, like, I'm actually one of you. You know, this is not me. Not really who I am. You know, it takes time to integrate something like this. And there is grieving, and there is loss, and there is frustration, and there is adjustment, and there is a lot of stuff to learn. And some people do it by being pissed off about it, you know, and that outlet of their anger is actually one of the things that can drive them. Or it's just the way they're grieving is just flowing out of them because of, you know, the reality of the loss of what they're dealing with. It's just another way of being human. But the people who use anger as a coping mechanism, after a while, they realize that there's consequences to that. You know, if you're going to be angry and rude to people, they're not going to be around you. They're not going to want to be around you. And that's what happens. And it's very interesting how many people I've met who have used anger, you know, not consciously, but anger was the way that they were coping with it. And then they have a story to tell about how they eventually woke up one morning and said, you know, this isn't helping me. I don't want to live like this. I don't want to have this energy going through my brain and my heart every day. And they went and they started apologizing to people and thanking them for hanging with them in their lives. And then, you know, they moved on in another way. So when I speak to people who are in those early stages, you know, I really encourage them to understand whatever they're feeling, whatever they're thinking is part of what's helping them get through that period. So it's important for you as professionals as well. When you encounter somebody who's like that, it's not necessarily easy, but you got to understand that there is some purpose to whatever is happening emotionally for them, that they're doing their best to maintain some control of their lives, some control of their very sense of self, because they feel like it's been pulled out right from under them. And so being forceful in the world is an adaptive survival process for these people. But you've got to draw your own line about, sorry, you don't get to talk to me like that and expect me to stick around. And so it's a process, because it's about being human, and being human isn't easy, and whether it's a disability or not, all of that complexity of our, you know, relations in the world and with people is still what's going on. We just have one more thing added to it, you know, that we have to deal with. Right? But it's all in the context of this wholeness of life. But what is truly amazing is how many people get through that adjustment process if they get support, if they get access to the services, if they get some sense of these possibilities and these potentials. Because that's what happens. In the beginning, you don't have a clue. You have no idea what it means in your life, what the impact is going to be, what is possible, how you're going to do whatever it is that you want to do, how you're going to integrate this feeling of these feelings of loss and letting go of dreams. You know, these are part of the process. In the beginning, that's all that's there. But then as people move through the process, they keep just going forward. It could be small steps, no matter what the pace is, but they just keep going forward with somebody to guide them who knows what's possible. You know, the professionals who understand what is possible and just get it. They are really carrying a vision for that person that they're working with, that that person can't yet get a grip on. But then little by little by little, you start to discover, oh, that's how it works. Here's how people do this. This is what's still possible for me that I was thinking wasn't, but oh, now I get that there is a way to do these kinds of things. People start to little by little find their path. You know, the light starts to dawn, and then this big, ugly, dark mass of impossibility starts getting a little smaller, and then people's attention starts going over here instead, because that's what we all want. We'd rather put our energy into what's possible than continue to stay stuck in, you know, the dark mass of dwelling on what we've lost in our lives. Doesn't mean it goes away, but it gets integrated. It's another part of that human capacity to adapt and integrate that is so incredible. Now, of course, there tons of things that I would rather be doing. I was a skier. You can sit ski, you can do that stuff, but I liked it a lot more on my feet. And, you know, I would love to be able to be on the beach. You know, I've got a wife, we've got a yellow lab. There are all kinds of places that I can't just go with them, whether it's the beach or hiking on trails. I was always a physical guy. I was an athletic guy. And, yes, there are still outlets for that, but there's a certain quality about it that I will just always miss. And there are times when I encounter a stare or a crowd or a setting, something that just isn't fun for me to be in because I'm sitting. And, yeah, I have a feeling about it. And then I move on. So it's not to minimize that feeling. It's just, you know, we all have desires and regrets or dreams maybe that we know we're not quite going to hit, but we're going to put our attentions on the ones that we can, right? Doesn't that feel better? So that's what everybody does. So for people with disabilities, it's the same thing. And it's not that it's some something special because they have a disability, like it's a compromise. It is the thing they're doing that you are also doing, making the choice to go where it's possible. So, for me, I haven't been as dependent on technologies as a lot of other people. People with significant hearing, vision impairment, with significant loss of hand and cognitive impairments and so on, rely on technologies more than I do. But there are a few technologies that really have meant a lot to me. One of them is the hand controls in my car. It's really a pretty simple device. But there are a number of designs for them. In the beginning, the one that I used was like a motorcycle to accelerate. But then I developed chronic tendonitis in my left lateral epicondyle from it. But I was also developing tendonitis in my wrists and all my elbows from being a hardcore computer user in my graphics career. That's why I left the graphics career and started doing ergonomics, because I developed tendonitis throughout my arms. So I have another set of disabilities that are not visible. My easy proneness, it's probably not a word, to flare up from doing computer work and overusing my arms a certain way. So the hand control is one of those things. So instead I use a hand control design now that you push down on it. It doesn't require any static grip. And another design, you pull it towards you. Same thing. Now you have to grip it, but now you got to use all this to pull it back and keep holding it. So I like the one that pushes down. You just have to have enough throw distance above your knee for it to be able to travel. And then there also are hydraulic types. And, you know, there's an amazing array of stuff now for driving. So to be able to drive, boy, you know, I had two older brothers, 5 and 8 years older than I was. And so I watched them, you know, have their bar mitzvahs and shave and date and do all this stuff before me. So I had to wait for every one of those things to be the last up. And driving was huge for me. So on my 16th birthday, I got my license. You better believe. And a couple of days later, I had my first car, 1959 Thunderbird. First car. So that has always meant a lot to me. My mobility in general means a lot to me. I'm more sensitive, maybe, than you are to having my mobility limited in any way. And so being able to drive is really huge for me, to be able to go on. I can rent cars. I have that freedom, that unimpaired freedom of mobility through the car. But the other big technology was the wheelchair. How much time do I have left, Dave? 10 or 15 minutes? Perfect. Might even get a little juggling in. And again, you haven't been laughing at the jokes, so. You can start any time. It's okay. The chair. What, the difference between this chair and the chair that I started out in is just light years. Am I in a spot where everybody can see this? Where should I best be? Is this good here? I'm trying to not make you guys. Let's see. Right. No. Right. Oh, but now you can't see it here. All right. Well, you know what? You deal with it. I'm going to stay here. You know, you're all familiar with the stereotypical standard style wheelchair. It's some kind of an aluminum chromed frame that's got cross braces in it, and it's got big wheels in the front, and it's got footrests. People's feet are way out here in the front, and, you know, maybe it's kind of rickety, and it's got some kind of a vinyl back on it of some kind. Armrests maybe that come out to here, and, you know, it might even be wide, and you see people wheeling in them kind of like this. That's where I started. At 18 in 1973, that was the state of the art, the Everest and Jennings so-called narrow adult lightweight wheelchair. Weighed about 50 pounds, even more with the cushion that I used in it, which was this heavy gel. Yeah, it's incredible, but it really was the state of the art at the time and deserves some respect for the advance that it does represent. Because Everest, I forget which one was which. Do you remember which one was which? Well, one guy was the injured guy and the other guy was the engineer. And they, you know, worked together to design this chair because they wanted to go places together, but they couldn't do it in that big lump cane back, I call it the Mr. Potter chair, you know, from It's a Wonderful Life, that big lurking thing that wasn't designed for people to control their independence. It was designed for pushing people around in it, right? So that's not okay. And so they designed the folding wheelchair with the detachable footrest that they could throw in the trunk, and all of a sudden, wow, big boost in their mobility. But then, I'll give you the history lesson very briefly. Then, in the 70s, there were a number of people who got injured, who got put into one of those chairs, who knew that it didn't have to be, who knew that there were materials, who had some design capabilities, that they understood that, wait a minute, we can do better than this. Are you kidding? People like Marilyn Hamilton, people like Roy Cooper, like Peter Axelson, believe it or not, that's really his name. Oh, lucky you. That's great. Peter's a great guy and a Paralympic athlete. Who am I leaving out? Ralph Hotchkiss, of course. So wheelchair users started designing better wheelchairs. Now, Marilyn Hamilton is the one of special note because she was also a savvy businesswoman. She was the one who took the ultralight wheelchair frame that now you could get in multiple colors. You know, her thing was the screaming blue neon wheelchair. And she created Quickie Designs. And all of a sudden, the Quickie became the new standard. And Everston Jennings, the big guy on top of the mountain who had stopped designing, who had stopped developing, who had stopped exploring the next possibilities, they got kicked off the mountain. The story is a lot more involved than that, but that's a simple description of it. And wheelchair design became revolutionized. But not just in terms of lightweight metals, but I've already alluded to it, appearance. It started looking less institutional. Does this look like I'm a hospital patient? No. It looks like it's just an extension of who I am, and it really has a different image, that I'm active, that I'm in control of my own mobility, and that I have a very different attitude about my disability. And it's more me and less the chair. Just the bulk of the chair is less part of my physical persona than it used to be. The other thing, there is something. Let's see the appearance. Oh, it'll come up. So the same thing is true of, that's right, adjustability. So those old chairs, you really kind of could pick certain frame sizes and things when you ordered it, but once you got it, it was pretty much fixed. You might have had a couple of positions for the axle on the frame. You might have had a couple of choices for the caster forks, or you could, you know, extend them or lower them or something like that, but you really couldn't do a whole heck of a lot with it. Well, Marilyn and these others started instituting highly adjustable wheelchairs that gave you a lot more control of the height and forward, in other words, center of gravity position of the main wheels. Many, many more options for casters, for seats, for backs, for brakes. Every component of the wheelchair all of a sudden was much more finely thought out. And for somebody in their first chair, they had the ability to experiment with what was the optimal relationship to their body in that chair. So you see, I don't have quite that much adjustability on this because as a 34-year wheelchair user, I pretty much know my dimensions. So this is a customized frame that's built to my specs because I don't need to play with it anymore, right? So I don't need as many moving parts. I don't have to pay the money for that. But for an early chair user to have that kind of control is really great. Control of what, you might ask? Well, the seat angle is an important starting point. Because this whole issue of how much balance you've got, depending on how much muscle you have access to. Notice my seat is maybe angling down just a little bit. Can you see that? It's called dump or squeeze, depending on what country you're in. And for somebody who has a lot of balance in their upper body in a manual wheelchair, they don't need so much angle because I'm not going to be falling forward. But for somebody who doesn't have control of this part of their trunk, they use more of an angle. So you'll start noticing this in chair users, that you'll see some variation in this because you're trying to find the optimal angle so that the person is stable in the chair so they can apply as much available muscular force to the push of the wheels as possible. And if somebody is struggling with making sure they're not falling out of the chair, they're not going to be able to get all that force into the wheel. Okay? So front floor to seat and rear floor to seat heights are separate specs, and they're crucial. And if you've got the ability to raise the axle up and down relative to the frame, you can play with that because also you can adjust the back angle, right? So you can imagine if the back seat goes down, the back itself is going to angle some, and so you want to bring it back up, which you can do with a rigid frame chair. There's no cross brace in this, right? That frees up the back to be able to be controlled at this pivot point down here so I can set the back angle wherever I want, as compared to the folding frame where the back was part of the vertical cane that went all the way down and you couldn't control it like that. So the rigid frame design freed up the back angle, freed up all this adjustability. These are simple things with huge import for people. The rigid frame is also valuable because it preserves the force that I apply to the wheel, so it translates into movement. With a folding frame, you lose some of that force in the very flexing of the frame when you push on it. But with a rigid frame, it's a lot more efficient, and it coasts a lot better, and it turns a lot more nimbly. And that's why, again, you're going to see people who are full-time manual wheelchair users mostly using rigid frame designs. Right. And I have spoken for 3 hours about wheelchairs, so I'll just hit on a couple more key points. Notice that my feet aren't way out in front of me. Right. They're in much closer to me, almost a 90-degree angle the way I'm sitting. Well, that's because the casters are small. Now, I'm a wuss. I like a soft ride. I don't like feeling all the cracks in the sidewalk. I used to use the big 6-inch inflatable balloon tires and just kind of deal with having to put air in them and flats and all that. Until these guys came along and designed the Frog Legs caster forks, which actually have a polyurethane nub in it that come in different degrees of firmness. It's shock absorption. And so now that means that I can have a smaller caster, but I don't feel every crack. It's a bit of a compromise, but it's really a worthy compromise because now I don't have to have this big space for the caster to travel in. That's why my heels had to be way out in front of me to make room for that caster to have all that space to turn on the axle fork. Is this making sense to everybody? Okay. You're engineers, of course it does. Yeah. So the radius comes in around the caster fork, so now my feet can come in. Now my total wheelbase is shorter. Now I can turn around in a store aisle. See, it all comes back to very real, daily, practical things. Okay? And I feel more normal. I just feel like I'm somebody sitting in a chair, far more so than when my feet were way out here in front of me. So these are a few examples of manual chair issues that I hope give you some sense of how radically manual wheelchair design has come, and power wheelchair design, I won't make it come up and model for us, but likewise, they used to just stick belts and motors and gears on those old folding wheelchairs and, you know, good luck. And if you were out in the rain on some kind of a slope, you used to use? No, but you heard the stories. Yeah, yeah. We all have our war stories from the good old days. So now power wheelchairs use direct drive motors that when you stop, it stops and it stays where it is. And they're designed from scratch. Many of them are very modular designs. You can choose a base and then put a seat unit on top of it that may or may not have tilt and recline systems, which allows somebody who can't do their pressure reliefs to be able to spend the entire day in the chair because they get to relieve the pressure by using the design of the chair to do that. I want you to think about that. Tilt and recline and pressure distribution cushion design, which is another major advancement, means that people who used to have to get out of the chair often over the course of the day or they were going to suffer substantial skin breakdown, potentially life-threatening skin breakdown, now they can spend the whole day in the chair. Now they're here getting educations. They're career-oriented. They can travel. They can do so much more because of the cushion and access to tilt and recline in power chair modular systems. You know, the controls themselves are programmable. You know, there are really high-end controls that can handle a shaky hand if somebody has one so that they're not jerking while they're moving around, that can actually change speed and acceleration and deceleration as they turn corners. I mean, it's just incredibly sophisticated. Puff and sip. Bleh. A little dyslexic, yeah. zip and puff devices or head controls, power wheelchair, and they're quieter. And then the same thing I was saying about this chair. They don't look as institutional. You know, some of them are these big hunkin' things, but still a lot better than looking than what they used to be. Shock absorption, solid fill tires. I mean, it's just amazing, incredible advances just in this whole world of mobility devices. So, any questions about chairs? This chair weighs under 20 pounds. And the handrooms. Here, this is a really interesting point, because Rory made this point to me, that I was asking him, so what's next? I actually wrote an article about this. So I interviewed all these guys and said, what's the next big thing coming up? What are the trends in wheelchair design? Well, you know, they've worked out the rigid frame. They've worked out shock absorption. All this stuff has kind of worked out. It's getting down to the hand rim now. So did you notice what's different about this one? It's not just that circular hand rim that many people are still using. And also, I've got some surface in here filling this gap, and it's rubberized. So first of all, I've got more surface to grip onto. I can get my fingers under here, so I have even more surface to grip onto. I can totally wheel on the rim rather than having to put my hand, my palm, on the tire itself. So my palms are not getting ripped up and calloused as much as they used to. And when I'm in the city accidentally wheeling through certain unnamed substances, you know, it's not going to... Everybody's had that experience. Oh. And this surface in here means my thumb gets some traction and gets to participate in the push. Right? So now they're getting down to the hand rim. It's really incredible. And power assist, and you'll talk about all that stuff. Okay. I never thought that I could ever live a life like this. If you had told me before I fell out of that tree and broke my back that I would ever be able to do the things that I've done, or that my life would turn out the way that it did, I really would have doubted it deeply. Not only that it was possible, objectively possible, but that it would be what I would do. But I got set on the path, and it just kind of went that way. And, you know, juggling is the same way. This is something I never, ever believed that I would ever learn how to do. But it really is just like the disability. It just was a matter of somebody coming along and teaching me the right way to do it. But no, even more than that, it was about my willingness to believe it was possible. Oh, you're just so aghast. And now I'm doing things that I'm still kind of amazed I can do. Because it turns out, after all, it's possible. There you go. Thanks. Sure. Dave, will you maybe get these out? A little... rather than a business card, something actually useful, a little bookmark thing. I do a lot of speaking about disability etiquette, because in the business world, what people are worried about is saying and or doing the wrong thing. That's really the starting point. So a lot of my work is about helping the business community get up to speed with the story I've been telling you, but also with the very real practical matter of, well, so you know, how do you interact with these people? And it turns out not to be such a big deal. They're just people like everybody else. But keep your damn hands off my wheelchair. unless I give you permission.
Are you working for veterans?
Not specifically. I have been to VA settings. I've been invited to some of that kind of stuff, and there certainly is the what's it called? The Returning Heroes program. What it's, I'm forgetting the name of it either, but there's a lot of activity going on there, preparing for folks coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to really optimize their opportunities to be able to get back to work. Hiring heroes, I think, is what it is. So, yeah, there are a lot more of them than we hear about, of course. But there's a lot of effort. Because, you see, right now they're in the military system, but they're about to become veterans as they get discharged. So the VA system is really gearing up for them. Yeah, and I would be honored to be invited to be of service.
I have a question. Have you been following the presidential campaign, and are you aware of some of the policies that some of the candidates
I'm aware. Yeah, I did follow that. I do a monthly email newsletter, and in the last one, I did a little survey of all of the candidates to see who had disability policies at all. Not a single Republican had any specific statement about disability policy on their websites, nor does the Republican National Committee. And I'm being completely objective about this. I'm not saying this because of my particular orientation. Of the Democrats, Dennis Kucinich had a statement, but it was out of date. John Edwards had a page, but Obama's the one who's really done it more than anybody else. He has got a pretty well thought out and worked through disability policy. He's got a video statement. He understands what the current disability issues are at play in Congress, and that includes not only access to health care. There's a 2-year backlog, people waiting to get on Social Security. People are dying waiting to get on Social Security just because they are totally backed up. There is the Community Choice Act, which is a Medicaid reform legislation, because right now, as a matter of state-by-state policy, many people are in nursing facilities simply because the state will only give them the money if they go into an institutional setting, rather than giving them the money for community living, which is way cheaper, and the data is totally clear on this. And so he gets that, you know, he says it by name. So Obama is the one who is the disability guy, and that doesn't mean I'm a one-issue person, and I'm therefore that he's the one I'm voting for, you know, just because of that. But to answer the question, and the Democratic National Committee also has a disability policy statement on its website. So that's what's going on. You know, this is an interesting question because disability policy, Social Security, health care, employment, you know, these are universal political issues at play that still get cast into this view of being about caretaking and dependency and charity and helping the disabled. It's not. It's about every single one of us. Because what's happening is the insurance companies, and I'm starting to rant now, the insurance companies do not want to cover people with disabilities, pre-existing conditions. 52 million people in the United States with disabilities, and who else, you know, with pre-existing conditions. Instead, the insurance companies turn them down. And if you look at the data, you see that private insurance health coverage is falling. Medicaid and Medicare is going up. Who, I ask you, is paying for Medicaid and Medicare? Every one of us. So people are being dumped into our pocketbooks so that the insurance companies can only cover the people that they're going to make a profit from. That's what's going on. It's one of many examples why disability issues are global political issues that everybody needs to get turned on to. Whew. Wow. You go, boy.
Any other questions that may require just a short answer?
I don't know if I'm capable of one. Well, I want to thank you guys for, you know, being here and for what you're doing and for the way you're going to be of service and the way that you're going to, you know, connect and what you're going to gain from it yourselves, you know, from this whole experience. And just, you know, go for it. Thanks a lot.